This is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. It is pre-recorded, however, so if you call in, no one will answer.
So since I was off last week, and if you hadn't listened leading into this week, you would have missed that I'm doing this program called Rewind, right? And it's through the University of Michigan, Michigan Medicine. And, you know, in 14 days, down 14 pounds, it's an amazing, amazing program. Well, anyway, old Sam Webb missed one of the key instructions to drink 64 ounces of water per day. And starting Tuesday of last week, you know, I started getting, you know, some negative symptoms, you know, increasing in their severity. And by Thursday morning, Ira could attest, I could hardly stand up. You know, totally my fault. I take all the blame. Some of those days I had maybe 24 ounces of water. Got to drink your water. There's this great medication called Lactulose that they prescribed for me. Got things back moving again. But that is the reason why I wasn't on last week's show. No other reason for the conspiracy theorists out there. So just wanted to clear that up at the onset. Glad to be joined once again by the MGO Blog Roundtable crew. Led, of course, first by Brian Cook, BC. Good morning. How are you?
Hello. I think I predicted a couple of weeks ago that something would drop that would force us to keep talking. And so here we are. My next prediction is that I will win $1 million.
Wait, why just you?
Everybody will win $1 million.
Everybody.
Except Dave Frandes.
$1 million for himself. Not spreading the wealth, man. We also have Craig Ross joining us again this morning. Craig, how are you?
I'm very well. I was extremely happy when last night Seth and I were doing a podcast about 1956 football. And he told me that John Behe was going to be on at 7 a.m. this morning. And so I got up earlier than usual to listen to John. And it was phenomenal. Congratulations to you, Sam and Ira, for having John on. And it was really, really fascinating interview. And I learned from it. It was great. Thank you.
I learned a ton from it as well. Learned a ton from Seth's piece the other day on Fielding Yates Show's. Great job, Seth. Seth Fisher joins us from MGO Blog. Seth, how are you?
Thank you. Still catching up on sleep from that, but
hey, man, you got to be thorough. So, yeah. As everyone you know listening to this knows, a few weeks ago we had a discussion about Bo Schembechler, Dr. Robert Anderson, the conversation about what to do with the name Schembechler Hall, what to do with the statue of Bo Schembechler outside of Schembechler Hall, in the aftermath of the of you know all of the examples of abuse at the hands of Dr. Robert Anderson. In the course of that conversation, I mentioned, hey, you know, what's the application elsewhere on campus? You know, we talked about CC Little. I brought up Fielding H. Yost. You know, talking about the Willis Ward treatment and, you know, other examples of racist beliefs. Little did I know at the time, and I don't know if you guys did, that the university had convened this panel to look into that very thing. MLive, Aaron McCann released a story earlier this week. I didn't see anyone else do it before him, that they have this panel of historians has recommended that Fielding H. Yost's name be removed because of a pattern of racist beliefs influencing his decisions as an administrator at the University of Michigan. With that, I want your just broad brush observations about finding out that this panel had been convened and the panel's ultimate conclusions, starting with you, Brian Cook.
Well, I mean, this is a situation where I usually talk a lot, and the other two guys on this podcast / radio show are much closer to their wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. So I'll basically defer to them in terms of like whether the name should be taken off the building. I don't really have strong feelings about that either way. You know, we had a similar conversation about Schembechler, where it's like we have a choice between sort of memory holding this and not maybe dealing with it, or like trying to explain that this person had a very mixed legacy. You know, I guess the nice thing is that the naming decision for the ice arena will take about 3 seconds if they do decide to change it. So it's not, you don't necessarily lose a whole lot of culture. I mean, I had honestly thought that maybe they should rename the hockey arena for Red Barons and even before this happened. So, you know, whatever happens, I'll be fine with it.
Seth?
Yeah, I mean, there are two things that they put out. They put out a 36-page history, and they put out a 6-page conclusion. And the history, I think, everybody needs to read. You know, that is a important part of the history of Michigan, and it shows you, you know, you mentioned a pattern of racist beliefs. It, really, we don't care about racist beliefs. It was racist actions, and specifically participating in a racist culture that was on campus, and a system that was designed to do it quietly without having to, you keep on looking for smoking guns, and the report tried to find these all the time, but there isn't no smoking gun. Like, this is a great look, and I think that's why everyone should read this, and I think everyone should read Behe's book that a lot of it was based off of originally. And I'm just talking about the 36-page history. It's important to read that because it shows you exactly how racism worked. All right, it was quiet. It was like, didn't have to say anything. Black people knew not to try out for Michigan, and Michigan didn't have any black people on the team. That's how it worked, right? And if it ever came down to it, so you don't ever got challenged on it, you know, they say, hey, do you, you know, allow any black players? Well, you know, Yost won't let me do that. And then you go ask Yost, and he'll be like, oh, well, the president wouldn't let me do that. You go ask the president, he'll be like, all the donors won't let me do that. Everyone passes the buck. No one ever wants to take responsibility for it. And what's interesting about the Willis Ward story, and this is very present in the report, is that there was something different that happened at Michigan that didn't happen at other places like Ohio State, where they would sit black players whenever the school asked them to. And it was student agitators made a big deal about it. They stuck it in their face. They said, if you want to sit this guy, we're going to sit out. We're going to protest. We're going to ruin your great big game. This is not going to happen on our watch. And they talked to alumni, and they got alumni to call. And Michigan had a lot of powerful alumni around the state at this time. And these student agitators made it a big deal. And because they made it a big deal, the next time it happened in another school, they had to worry, oh my God, are we going to create this hornet's nest? Which is not what they were thinking about before. You look at the decision that Ohio State made in 1930 and 31 to sit their player Bell. They were worried about, what are the racists going to think? What's the South going to think? How will we take care of them, right? And that, more than anything, tells us is the history that people need to learn, that you have to agitate, that you have to get in their face, or this is just going to stay quiet and underground and continue to happen. That's in the 36-page history. The 6-page conclusion, I found a lot of problems with. To me, it seemed like, and that was where they said, here's our basis for removing the name. And one of the things that I had a problem with most was this idea that they want to make a moral map, that names of buildings in the university should represent the ideals of the university, which is a great goal. But the Michigan Daily writers, Jared Dougal and Christian Giuliano, did a study last March where they found out of the 103 building names that we have on campus, 78% of them are named for men. 99.3% of them are named for white people. We have one building on campus, one that is named for a person of color. And that's the Multicultural Center. And it's named for William Trotter, who is not an alum, but he's the founder of one of the founders of the NAACP. And another person who made his whole life about this whole thing, the same lesson that we learned from the Yost history, that you had to agitate. That was his whole thing. That's the only building on campus that we have named for a black person right now. So I don't see what the moral map is. And that, I don't really, like Brian, I don't really care if they change the name, but I think that that standard doesn't make any sense to me. I think the standard of holding one person accountable and saying that was racism because we had this guy doesn't make any sense to me. This was a very widespread, went all the way to the top, went all the way to the bottom, and it was the culture back then. And it doesn't excuse anything that Yost did. He was part of it. He was a participant of this system. But the system is the problem, and the system still exists today.
Craig Ross.
I agree with what Seth just said completely. Starting backwards, if they want to change Yost Arena's name, that's fine with me, I guess. But I would like to see them then review all the buildings on campus. I would probably start with Angel Hall, which I would, from what I know, leave it at Angel Hall, because that guy was an incredible guy. And he really made the university more than any other person. But, so did Yost. If you were going to name two people who created a university, the University of Michigan, which I think we all love, one would be James Burrell Angel, and the other might be Fielding Yost. And so that makes it complicated for me. On the other hand, if they want to change Yost Fieldhouse to Willis Ward Fieldhouse or Red Berenson Fieldhouse, I'm fine with it. But I also like the idea of changing or of a review of all 102 names of all 102 buildings on campus. But here's the bigger thing to me. As opposed to naming or changing the names of buildings, why not celebrate and black athletes who struggled, particularly in the early days of this university, and early females, particularly black females, who had a very difficult time here at the university, and why not celebrate them with some sort of a museum and a history and with some nuance of what their experiences were. And connected to that, and this really bothers me, there was a time, I believe, when about 10, Seth, you may know this, 10 to 13, 14% maybe even of the entering class at the University of Michigan.
Yeah, so my graduating class, I looked this up last night after we talked.
Okay, thanks.
13.5% of my graduating class of 2002 was African American. The last graduating class was 4.4%.
Yeah, and so that to me is a bigger deal and more consequential than whether Yost Fieldhouse is Berenson Fieldhouse or some other fieldhouse. It seems to me those things are much more meaningful. In terms of the specifics of the report, I found it woeful, and I was stunned to realize that they'd never talked to John Behe. I mean, you have to understand, John Behe, when he did his work, Hail to the Victors, which has Willis Ward on the cover of it, incidentally, he talked to and interviewed 25 black athletes who were still alive from the first half of the 20th century. And those I've listened to some of those interviews because some people might recall that at Sam's and Ira's encouragement, last year, we talked about these in some of my solo sessions about people like DeHart Hubbard and Willis Ward and George Jewett and Marcus Fleetwood Walker. We talked about those people and what their experiences were and histories were at the university. But that they didn't talk to Behe, who I talked to, I felt like if I'm going to talk about these athletes, I need to talk to Behe, and I found him. I think Seth has talked to him, or perhaps had even talked to him before I had, and Greg Dooley perhaps also. And so it seems pretty surprising to me. They also didn't talk to John Bacon, who's written extensively about Yost, which is pretty disappointing. It seems to me John should have been talked to, and I think they even sort of misuse some of John's writing in a way that's sort of treacherous, I would say. And let me, I mean, and to some extent, this is less of a history and more of a legal brief. And it starts, and this is a lawyer's trick, and it's a good one, is lawyers often start with their weakness. They don't want the other side of the case to pound away at them. So they start with their own weakness in the case to minimize the impact of their weakness. And the first paragraph of this history is...
About
Gerald Ford. Now, if anyone should not have a name on the building, it's Gerald Ford. I mean, sorry. I mean, he was in buddies with the racist anti-Semite Richard Nixon. He was involved in a war that, to me, up to his knees or his neck, in a war that was, to me, racist and genocidal. And among other things, he was involved in the Warren Commission. I won't get into that. He and Alan Dulles ran that rat and pony show. And so there's plenty of negative things to say about Gerald Ford, but they make Gerald Ford the hero.
And it was a piece of campaign literature, right? I think that the history of it is he, like the rest of his teammates, because, you know, Gerald Ford was rooming with Willis Ward. They were, correct, you know, that part is true. And yes, and they were in the same class and came up together, and classes were really close with each other. And that is true as well. So I'm sure he was upset, as the rest of the team were upset, about them benching Willis Ward, especially because the team, they lost every game after that. That undermined the entire team. No one had a good effort. In fact, Willis Ward scored every single point that Michigan scored the rest of the season,
which wasn't very many, incidentally.
No, it was like 12 points. But you could tell that the team was trying to get Willis Ward's back by doing that, and by, you know, that was the only thing that motivated them the rest of the season. They didn't care about winning the rest of the year. And I think that part's true. I don't think what's true is that he threatened to quit if they played him, or that Willis Ward said anything to him. I think that Jerry was with the rest of the team, and they were told this, and they were upset. And then when he was running for president in 1976, all of a sudden, this has to be addressed, because otherwise he's part of this story. And I think opposition Richard said, well, here's a problem. He was on this team where they sat the only black player when they played Georgia Tech. Mm-hmm. And so he had to get out in front of it, and that's the story. And it's unfortunate that we tell the story that way, because the truth of it was very important that not everybody felt that way. But again, it's not about the feeling. Most people didn't feel that way. Most people felt they just wanted to keep things quiet. And that's how racism works. And I think we got to keep on coming back to this, because that is what's in the report. And that's the history of Yost on campus, that he wasn't any different than most of the people who were in power in his day. And the people who were in power in his day cared about what the racists thought, because they were going to agitate. And until people who were anti-racism agitated, they didn't care what they thought about.
Yeah, I mean, finishing my, if I could, because this to me was important. At the beginning of this report, they tell the story that Gerald Ford was not going to play in this game, that he was going to sit out too, but that he went to Willis Ward and Ward convinced him to play. Now, I listened to the tape of Behe interviewing Willis Ward on this back last year. Willis Ward, from my hearing of this, does not support that story. In fact, he says, no, this story is a fairy tale. And what does the committee do with it? They put it front and center as Gerald Ford hero, in this story. And then in the footnote, it says, in the bottom of the footnote, it says, it's not actually clear.
Gotta talk to the mic, Craig. Talking to the mic.
Okay, it's not exactly clear. Excuse me,
Craig. Can I cut you off for a second here?
Sure.
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to make the point that the committee, when they were making this report, were trying to place Yost somewhere in a position of, you know, he was more racist than other people on campus at the time.
Right.
Which I think if they talked to John Behe, and if they talked to John Bacon, if they talked to the guys at the Bentley, they would have gotten a lot better perspective about what was going on and how it really worked, right? And I think that they tried to make the case that Fielding Yost was different than the other people on campus. And they use that as an example, and they use the student protesters as an example. And that just wasn't true. What was true is that Michigan was different than other schools because Michigan had protesters. And what did Yost do? This is very important that Yost not only did not meet the moment, Yost hired Pinkertons to go and investigate those students who were agitating against him, right? And he had them report back, and they brought back three names. Now, I think the Pinkertons selected, because when I looked back and tried to see who was leading this movement, it actually looked like there were different leaders. But they chose three Jewish guys to be the leaders and gave those names to the president of the university. And President Ruthven dismissed those students a few months later. So that when you look at what Yost did, he didn't just fail to meet this moment. He, you know, actively in 1934, at the end of his career, actively participated in buttressing the racist system that existed on campus. You want to ask the question, was he racist? I don't really care what's in your heart. I care what you do. And what he did was help to assist the system. He used Pinkertons to investigate people. He attacked the protesters instead of listening to what they're saying and using that moment and using this opportunity to stand up and say no. And he could have done so.
Yeah, I think so.
I agree with that.
A couple of things here. I think that when you look at the response of the student body at the time, if you're looking to highlight something, someone, or some people that represent an ideal that stands to up to a historical measure, then that's what you highlight. You highlight the student response that in the face of societal inertia, as I call it, or even the inertia of leadership on campus at the time, you had a very vehement opposition. And according to John Behe, he said it was a powder keg. All hell broke loose. He made it sound like it wasn't just one or two students. You had a movement of people on campus where it had yo saying like, oh, crap, I can't just ignore this. I actually have to respond to this. I mean, we got to have students investigated. We got to move to silence them, which is why I asked him, was this in line with his personal beliefs, or was he just going along with the gang, with the mentality of the day? And then receive pushback on campus. I think that's important in helping frame your view and opinion of Fielding Yost. Personally, I told you guys when we talked about this with Bo Schembechler, I just don't get wrapped up in names of buildings. It's just not a thing for me. If you're looking for a sort of an idealistic approach to this that can be functional, I think it's necessary to highlight two things. Number one, like I just said, the student protest. As an example of, you know, the students being an example of the leaders and best, the people leading and shaping the views of the image of the university. Highlight that. But if you want the Fielding HO story to be functional, I think it's important to acknowledge it. Just like we said when we were talking about Bo Schembechler, make it work for you. Make it be a lesson. Make it inform people of today. What do I mean by that? We were talking yesterday about this total side and tangent, but it all wraps together. We were talking about how Russell Westbrook is doing this documentary about the Greenwood District in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's a story of it started with a black shoe shiner allegedly assaulting a white woman in an elevator. The result of that allegation was the complete and total pillage of an entire district. They called it Black Wall Street, decimation, murder of hundreds of black people. Fast forward to Emmett Till. He whistles at a white woman, gets lynched. The Rosewood Massacre, allegedly, you know, assaulting a white woman. They burn down and tear down the town. Fast forward to the here and now. So a couple of years ago, you have a story of a guy in Central Park, you know, bird watching. A woman comes up with her dog off leash. He tells her to put the dog on a leash. She gets mad, calls the cops and says, this black man is harassing me. Now, that's clearly an example of racism, right? Mm-hmm. Clearly something that she needs to be reprimanded for. But it was a huge deal to black people because it wasn't just about that racist incident. It was about what that particular instance represented historically. There is a long history of, in this particular case, white women making allegations that can lead to harsh consequences for black men. Getting back to this story with Fielding HOs and the restriction for, in this case, black athletes between George Jewett and Willis Ward, there were none. There were no black football players anyway.
No black varsity. No one on varsity. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you have a restriction of access in that time that I think is indicative of a much broader picture. And if you illustrate to people how close we are to that, how we aren't far removed from such a thing, then it might help shape their opinions differently on things like affirmative action, right? Where you just talked about how the numbers for your class were 13% and they're 4% now. You have a lot of people who think, oh, I mean, that's a long time ago, where access to opportunities, restriction as far as opportunities, that was way, way, way back then. That is no longer in place now. When you illustrate stories like this, when you highlight stories like this, I think it better informs opinions, can help shape some opinions on things. And it's not me saying that affirmative action is a racial thing only. It's not. It's made a racial thing, but it's not only a racial thing. But in having discussions about a topic like that, highlighting examples like this, I think it's functional. And I think that's what that's the reason you acknowledge something like this. I don't care if it's about taking a name off a building or leaving it up with some acknowledgement of this part of his story too. Whatever you do, I think that's the purpose. That's the function, more than this idealistic thing about names representing your moral compass. That's a heavy standard to hold up to. The country doesn't even do that. So it's hard for me to expect the university to. To me, it's about teaching. It's about informing opinions moving forward. They have an opportunity here that moves beyond whether or not you just take a name off a building, in my opinion.
All right. Yeah.
Amen. I'm not going to disagree with a single word you said, and I agree completely, and I'd much rather see the university do other things than obsess about names on buildings, even Gerald Ford, who I despise. And
something
else.
One of the stories one of the stories that they mentioned was a 1928 letter from Tad Wyman, who was one of Yost's top assistants. He was his offensive line coach. They did both teams, and then actually coached Michigan for a little bit under Yost, and then quit because Yost was like interfering too much. But he was having a conversation with a alumni who was trying to recruit a black guy named Belford Lawson. Trying to recruit another guy, but he brought up the story about this player, this running back, Belford Lawson, who was written about by James Tobin in 2009 in the Ann Arbor Observer. And they brought this article out where they had Tad talking to Belford Lawson Sr. about, like, hey, do you play black players or not? And he told him, well, you know, here's what we did. Like, we had a guy, he wasn't good enough to play varsity, so we didn't put him on like the second team. We didn't have him on the dress team, right? They kept him off the dress squad because it would have offended too many people. We liked the guy on the team. We loved him. He was a great guy. And in fact, he went on to be an important civil rights attorney. But they kept him off. They kept him out of view because they didn't want to offend people. And I think these are the stories that tell you, you know, you want to use that to you know, go after Yost and say Yost was a racist man, and Yost was and let's take the name off the building and that will solve the problem. You are missing the whole problem, right?
Yeah.
This stuff is under the surface, and it is going to stay under the surface and stay quiet, and they're going to quietly do a lot of things not to offend people and not to get people upset and not to get people crying about cancel culture until you stick it in their face. And the movement that existed on campus then is the same movements that we have today, right? We have different names, but it's the same movement. And the people who and the reactions that they had and the way they reacted was the same way they reacted today. You know, it's
we need to get to a break.
Yeah,
we'll come back to the other side. You can pick up that thought, Seth. And we got a request to finish the Willis Ward Gerald Ford comment. I don't know if you had not finished that comment yet. Craig. Okay.
I can finish that. Yeah.
Yeah. When we come back on the other side here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, the ticket.
Well, I wonder what we'll get this week.
Clear.
Look, man, you got to be able to have it.
You got to be able to talk about stuff.
I really don't care. You know, we're having an honest discussion like we did a few weeks ago. So this, you know, the responses are going to be, you're going to get those that agree, those that disagree. I think it's part of it. You know, not a monolith out there. When we talked to John B., John very clearly believes that, you know, the name shouldn't be taken off the building.
Yeah,
right. He said he was very explicit.
He was very explicit about that, that while highlighting the racist attitudes and how he missed the moment. And to Seth's point, it was more than just indifferent. That he was a contributor, he feels, John does, that the contributions far outweigh his negative contributions to this particular story, especially because they were part and parcel of the times, that they were indicative of how most people were feeling. I think necessary in this context, though, is to bring up that you had huge protest on campus, huge pushback on campus. And a student body that made it clear even then that you aren't meeting the moment. And, you know, does that change your view if you realize that? For some it will, for some it won't. It's why I'm not caught up on that. I mean, you can tell that story and it's not going to move some people who are the reverence is so great that, you know, you can't tell them enough bad to take a name off. But you might be able to move them when it comes to, hey, we need to tell this part of the story too. And that's where I come in. You need to tell that part of the story too, because it can wake people up to some things that are still present right now. I think that's what you should be focused on if you're Michigan, in my opinion. That's my humble opinion.
You're right about these things. It's, I want to save this for later, but, you know, we're recruiting Jordan Phillips right now, right? The defensive tackle out of Ocoee. I don't think most people at Michigan, I bet most people on this panel don't know what the word Ocoee means, right?
I didn't know anything about this story until someone contacted me about talking about Jordan Phillips.
Yeah.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. So, I mean, 100 years ago, in 1920, Ocoee had a vibrant black population, and then somebody went down there and tried to register them to vote. Which, boy, that's not at all a problem today, right? That's not at all an issue today. You know, black voting, that's not something that people talk about at all in 2021, right? And they got massacred. They got attacked by the population for trying to vote. It was on election day. And it wiped out the population. And for 50 years, there were no black people who lived in Ocoee. And the fact that, like, you know, I had to learn that recently. You had to learn that recently.
I consider myself very versed in black history, and I did not know that story.
Yeah. And so these stories, like I said, the whole way racism works is it's quiet, right? They keep it on the DL. And as long as nobody, you know, stirs the pot. And then when someone tries to stir the pot, just like what happened when John Behe went to Chrysler and said, hey, here's what I want to do as a follow-up to my Yost book. I want to talk about black athletes at Michigan before 1948. And Chrysler says, well, why do you want to open that can of worms?
Right.
Why do you want to look at that? Keep it
back in 1 minute on radio, guys. We're back in 1 minute on radio.
And that's what happens. Why do you want to talk about Ocoee? Keep it quiet. That's how it works.
Exactly. My point exactly. My point exactly. Couldn't have said it any better.
Yep.
Yeah. So we're getting some positive response. I mean, if you're looking for some feedback, Craig, there you go. There's some feedback.
Thank you, Sean.
Now, I'm sure that there'll be some dissenters.
Yeah, I know.
Who think this is ridiculous. Why are you talking about this? Or you should be more pronounced. Just, you know, tell them they should take it off.
I do want to say, like, I read the comments on my article because, you know, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't way off base, right? And
all right, guys, we're coming back on the radio. Okay. Sorry to jump in there, Seth.
Okay. But
let me count you guys in. Back on radio in 5, 4, 3.
And we have folks here on the Michigan Insider, Sports Talk 1050 WTKA, online at WTKA.com. Sam Webb, Mr. Ira Weintraub on the other side of the county, and the MGO Blog Roundtable back with us, Brian Cook, Craig Ross, Seth Fisher. And Seth, I sort of cut you off before we went to the break. I want to allow you to finish your thought before we get over to Craig and have him finish his conversation or thoughts on Gerald Ford and Willis Ward.
I don't remember exactly where I was because we were talking about just how the system worked, and that it was a much broader system, and that even we want to talk about the people on campus who agitated against sitting Willis Ward at that moment. It was a large protest, especially for campus at that time, but it was not by any means a majority. And there was a counter protest, the Mishagamowa people, who had a terrible, horrible racist name for Yost. They jumped in and tried to break the thing up. So, I mean, you look at the history, and I think that's what I want people to do. I don't care about the name. The name is such a small-time thing. It's such a small part of this whole story. And Yost was actually, just a bit player in this much larger story. And I think if you try to focus too much on how progressive things were at that point, you're going to miss the way that it actually worked, which was that you had people who would get upset if you violated their racism, and people who would get upset if you were racist. And the people who got upset if you were racist were getting squashed and put down and told not to talk, and had Pinkerton sent against them and were dismissed from the university.
I mean, doesn't that feel disqualifying, though? Like, we're talking about how we're kind of on the fence here, but, like, this is an affirmative action against University of Michigan students that resulted in the expulsion of three guys because they were opposed to sitting Willis Ward. And it seems like, to me, like, if we're arguing about how complicit this person was, that seems like something that like, we talk about how the culture at the time was the culture at the time, and we're trying to teach people on modern standards. That seems like above and beyond, doesn't it? Like,
yeah,
I haven't heard about that happening elsewhere.
It happened elsewhere. And that's part of the problem. This was that was the modus operandi of administrators of that day and age. I'm sure I pronounced it incorrectly, but
you got it right. I just like making my French sounds at you.
That was perfectly in line with how people acted back then, and perfectly in line with how a lot of people in positions of power still act today. And that's the greater point. I mean, you want to ask me the question straight up, was Yost racist? I think he was racist. I don't have no problem saying that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a question. If you want to ask the question as simply as, do we want to name buildings on campus after racists? No, but I've never walked into a building with a named after a person and thought to myself, I bet that person was a great guy, right? I imagine that these are, people who gave to the institutions, either financially or through their efforts. And, well, like that, if they change it, like, I'm really agnostic on whether they change it. I think that Yost's contributions to the university should be recognized. I think that his performance in this case should be told to everybody. But I want to get back to the system. I think it was systemic, and I think that he was a player in that system, and the system is the thing that we should be focused on, not the one guy.
Craig, so we got a request from Thomas, who said, and I'll read it for folks who aren't watching online, say, please finish the Willis Ward fantasy Gerald Ford comment, please.
Okay. What happened was that obviously Yost should not have buckled into Georgia Tech, and it was absolutely wrong. What Yost did with Pinkertons is, and what Ruthven did was unspeakable. Ford tried to make himself less culpable in this, because Ford always claimed, hey, I'm Willis Ward's roommate, or I was, and he was. I was the captain of that team, I believe he was. And how come you then, Gerald Ford, acceded to this? How come you played? And his story always was, because, hey, other people on the team, including Ward, could have said, I ain't playing. Ward ain't playing, I ain't playing. And they could have done that, but they didn't. And Ward's answer was, I talked to Willis and Willis told me, no, I want you to play. And that's the story that was that Ford repeated on the, you know, over and over. And in fact, I think at his funeral, even George Bush told this story. Well, this report tells that story. And then in a footnote, it says, well, it isn't all that clear whether Ward and Ford even talked before the game about this. That's a little disingenuous, too, because I listened to Behe's interview with Willis Ward, and Willis Ward says affirmatively, I never talked to Gerald Ford about that. Hmm. And so go back to the Bentley. Maybe this is a year and a half ago when I listened to that interview, but and I wasn't obsessing about that particular point at the moment. But I'm pretty sure, because Behe presses him on that. Behe is a good interviewer. And Behe presses him on that. And Ward says, I never talked to him. And I never told him to play. That's not true. So who do you believe? Gerald Ford or Ward, Willis Ward? I know who I believe, and it ain't Gerald Ford. And so, but that the report would tell this story and lead with it. And somehow leave Gerald Ford as a sort of quote hero or at least absolved in this is just mind boggling to me. So that's my point.
Yeah, great stuff. I gotta shout out Seth because you know you mentioned something in the break about Okoye.
Yeah,
and about Okoye, about Jordan Phillips, the recruit out of Michigan, who Michigan is looking really 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 good for, by the way, like really really good for. But that's a side point. When I first started covering Jordan Phillips, and I just pulled up the message that I got from an Okoye resident. So shout out to Eric Reichenberger, who I know listens to the show, my man Eric. And so he was the one who contacted me. And he said, hey, do you know the history of Okoye? This is back in February. Mm-hmm. So I know all about it. I just talked about the Greenwood Massacre, which many people know as the Tulsa Massacre. I'd heard about the Rosewood Massacre, had never heard about the Okoye Massacre. And Seth, if you could, because you talked about it in the break, want to allow you the chance to bring people up to speed, then I'll jump back in.
Sure, sure. It was 100 years ago on it was 100 years ago on Election Day. So it's 1920 on Election Day. In response to Black residents of Okoye, and Okoye had a thriving middle-class Black population, and they were being registered to vote. So people had gone around and gotten them registered, and then on Election Day, they were threatened. If you try to vote, something's going to happen to you. And they came with guns, they attacked women and children, they attacked anybody. First they, you know, beat up and then and lynched people trying to vote. And then ran everybody out of town, ran every single Black resident of Okoye out of that. And for 50 years, there was not a single Black person who lived in Okoye.
Right. And so why is this relevant? Now, I think it speaks to the point, going back to our conversation about, hey, you know, what are you going to do with the Schembechler statue? What are you going to do with the Schembechler Hall name? And my response was, you know, at the end of the day, it really doesn't move me much either way. But whatever you do, have some acknowledgement of this part of history, too. It's important to illustrate it for posterity's sake because it helps inform opinions moving forward. If you're ignorant to history, the saying goes, you're doomed to repeat it. Now, does that mean in the case of Okoye, Florida, or in the case of you know, the story about the Greenwood District, which is getting a lot more attention now that we are going to see a district burned and pillaged and hundreds of people, you know, murdered as a result. No, but it could take a different shape. It could take a different form. In the case of Okoye, you could see some what many people might see as voter suppression. Others will see, oh, this is just an overreaction. Well, if you right. have...
Why are you agitating? Why are you being so loud?
Why is this a big deal? This is not something that is relevant now. Well, if you had some historical context, you might see some parallels that make you aware, wait a minute, we aren't that far removed from issues like this. In the case of the what we're talking about now with Fielding H. Yost, I really don't care about the name of the building. to remove the name in and of itself to me is utterly symbolic, not necessarily functional. You have an opportunity here to apply some function by teaching people. And I think if you highlight how, again, from a positive standpoint, you had the student body embodying the protest spirit that you still see to this day. If you want to celebrate something, celebrate that. But teach them the lesson about the restrictions that were placed on even athletes at that time. I mean, the ones who you think allowances would be made for, restrictions were placed upon them. And it might inform their opinions today on some things like affirmative action. Things where, like you said, Seth, you come in, man, they're 12, 13, 14%. Now you've seen some new policies come into place. And what is it now? It's 3 or 4%. Maybe people's opinions and views, I'm not saying this will be a universal response, but maybe a few more people will start to think about things differently. They will start to realize that maybe the past that we celebrate as the wonder years weren't necessarily so wonderful for everyone. And it wasn't that long ago that, you know, the things that people are talking about now more visibly wasn't that long ago where, you know, the country was doing some things in more in plain view than you might know when you look at the history books. You raise their attention to that. Maybe that can be functional. Maybe that can help elicit some change. That to me should be the focus. If you want to be idealistic about it, do something more than changing the name on a building. Educate people about the role that was played in restricting access. Educate people about how there are examples of restricted access today. Now you're doing something.
Yeah.
More than just being symbolic.
Well, and I think when you stick to one person, and this is kind of going back to Brian asked, directly, don't you think that disqualifies him? That taking action against students of the university, doesn't that disqualify him? Sure. Like I said, I don't care if they change the name on Yoast. I think that it's such a small thing. Focusing on one person, it's like digging up a Tyrannosaurus skeleton, being like, aha, we found who ate all the dinosaurs, right?
What did I say a couple of weeks ago? I said, look, if you want to apply this measure, apply this measure in history, blow up Mount Rushmore then.
Right.
Blow it up.
Well, and the story continues after Yoast. After Yoast died, Michigan had a quota system. You go and look at the photos of Michigan's teams in the 1950s and 1960s, and you're going to notice, you know, white, black, white, you know, every class only got to have one guy. And it went until 1968. And if you look at the 69 team photo, I put this in my article, but if you start zooming in on that, it's incredible how white the first half is. And then once you see where the sophomores and freshmen are sitting, all of a sudden it's a lot more mixed. Gosh, you know, that no one said anything, right? They didn't have to say anything. If you had to say something, that's how the system broke. They kept it quiet, but they had a quiet quota system, and this was across college athletics, after Fielding Yoast died, to only have a couple black players at a time. And those few black players had to be greater than great to play for Michigan.
And let me be clear. Look, I'm not advocating for blowing up Mount Rushmore. don't send me messages.
Am Webb cancels Rushmore.
Don't send me messages about that. I'm saying that I've gotten to the point where I don't look at such symbols. I guess I have a realistic view or a pragmatic view to it. I just don't think that you can say enough bad about some individuals in history to make people get on board with that enough to see some actual change. Even when we talk about Yoast, I think the reverence is so great and his contributions are so significant that, you know, you can rationalize that paradox. As I say, hey, he was just a product of the times. You're going to have a lot of people that say that. But I think you can find some consensus, or at least more of a consensus, with people that might go with, we need to educate, we need to enlighten, we need to show this side too. And if we do that, then maybe that can be a part of affecting change now, more so than taking a name off a building or blowing up a statue, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that you need to do is get them to empathize with people. And empathy comes from hearing the stories and not from vilification. You vilify one person, you're going to have people thinking, oh my God, I'm going to get vilified too, right? How many idiots in the message board are responding, oh, now they're going to cancel everybody else too, right? Not everybody else had a protest on campus against one of their decisions, right? If we only keep it to that, you're still having a very small number of people, right? So I don't think that focusing on one individual helps that much, because then it helps you ignore the system. It helps you ignore the problem continues, and helps you and breaks the ability to see how the system then is still in place today, right? If you talk about COE as this horrible murder, and you don't talk about, you know, the next 50 years of suppression, and then talk about voter suppression today, you're going to miss the big picture. You're going to misunderstand what that was about. You know, if you talk about what happened in Tulsa, where Black Wall Street was burned to the ground, and don't talk about, the New York Times study that went out today about how out of the people who grew up in the 20%, the top 20% of America, I think most of the white people end up rich, and most of the Black people end up poor. If you don't talk about these things that are still going on in our society and see that they have their basis in the way that we dealt with things back then, you're not gonna get anywhere. And you need to tell the Yo story, because
yeah,
people
you're preaching a sermon right now, by the way.
Yeah,
you're preaching a sermon right now. This is the value, and I'm only cutting you off because we're out of time.
Yeah,
this is why you acknowledge it. It's not just about holding up for shame or accountability for the perpetrators. It's about the lessons you teach moving forward. It's about informing perspectives and opinions now in a way that could be functional, in a way that can help make change. You want to represent something. If you're Michigan, you talk about having your ideals and morals be represented. This is the way you do it, by shining, holding up a mirror to your past, right? Shining a light on it. There's an opportunity to celebrate some things. You can celebrate your student body. If you're looking for some people to hold up and you know, canonize, if you will, you have that opportunity there, not necessarily with Fielding Yost in this particular instance, but that's not the important piece. The important piece to me is how you shape opinions, what you do in your process moving forward, whether we're talking about the Schembechler statue and names, and the victims that were abused. That's why it's, look, what do you do? What process do you have in place now to prevent abuse like this from ever happening again? As much as you need to have attention given to the victims of this abuse, that absolutely needs to be at the first and foremost in the attention of the university. You had better be focused, have a huge amount of focus on educating not just your student population, your alumni population, but also informing leadership in the future. This is what you need to avoid. These are the mistakes we made. And the same thing with this case, with Fielding HOs. This is what we did wrong. This is how we were wrong. This is how the students were right in this instance, but this is why it matters to acknowledge it now. Look at our student population on campus. Are we really that far removed from restrictive practices? Do we still practice them in some way? That's why it's important to acknowledge, in my opinion. But we are out of time. We are out of time. Was that too heavy for the people? I don't know. Could be. I'm sure we're going to get positive and negative responses.
At least for being loud.
Yeah, we welcome both. We welcome both. Now, we're going to get some complaints, because more Brian, more BC. We need more Brian Cook.
Well, I explained that this is a part where I should be quiet and listen to other people.
Right. So, no, always great to have you guys on. Love the MGO Blog. This should be an example. How about this for a message? Lessons that we learn. The MGO Blog Roundtable should never freaking go away. I mean, it should never have an off season. Here I am speaking for you guys, right?
Maybe if it goes away, we'll stop getting bombshells.
All right, we got to get out of here, guys. We are out of time. Of course, we'll be back next week. I am volunteering the guys for another edition of the MGO Blog Roundtable. Ira and I are off for Friday and Monday for the holiday, so we'll see you next time on the Michigan Insider on Tuesday here on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, The Ticket, the official voice of University of Michigan Sports Ann Arbor, a Cumulus station.